With a 50% obesity rate in the U.S. and more unhealthy people than ever before, it is time to make America healthy. Welcome to Make America Healthy with Beth Shaw. If you're feeling tired, toxic, heavy, slow, or stressed, then keep listening. Beth and her expert guests are here to offer practical advice and share the tools you need to reclaim your physical, mental, and emotional health. Now, here is your host, Beth Shaw.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Make America Healthy, where we empower you with information and education so you can take your health into your own hands and make responsible, healthy choices for your body and your mind. Today's topic is pain management. So if you are suffering from chronic pain or acute pain, stay tuned because we've got some great guests and information for you. We've got Dr. Dave Candy on the show, who's been helping people age 40 and above stay active, mobile, and healthy without relying on pain medication, injections, or surgery. Big shout out to Dr. Dave Candy. He is a board-certified specialist in orthopedic manual physical therapy, and he owns More for Life in St. Louis. It's a clinic, and is the author of the best-selling book, Chronic Pain. You're not just getting older, you're not crazy, and it's not all in your head. He's got a great bio, and we're so happy to have him. We've also got on Rick Alderman, who is a sports and orthopedic physical therapist with over 25 years of experience specializing in helping people with chronic pain experience a pain-free life. He has written a series called Fixing You. It's books. They're on Amazon, helping people with injuries or chronic pain. And there are also downloadable video home programs. He's got a new book coming out called Solving the Pain Puzzle in 2023. So welcome to both of my pain management guests. This is a big topic. You know, it seems like more and more people are in physical pain. Obviously, we know a lot of people right now are suffering from emotional and mental pain, but there seems to be a rise in people having pain in their bodies. And we'd like to get to the root or the roots of what those pains are and give our listeners some practical tips to manage their own pain or avoid it. So as many of our listeners know, I am the founder and CEO of Yoga Fit Training Systems, the world's largest yoga mind body school. And we have been helping people stay pain-free with yoga and other mind body tools for over 25 years. Fortunately, I don't have very many pains in my body. I guess listening to the body helps. But Dr. Candy, tell us about your background and what do you do to help people with pain?
Sure, Beth. First of all, thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate being here. And it is interesting that you mentioned the rise of physical and emotional pain because, you know, as I think we'll unwind during the show here, that chronic pain especially is intertwined with the body and also the mind, much as you mentioned you practice during yoga. So we help people who largely haven't been able to be helped by other sources. And sometimes that does involve looking past just what's going on in the body and looking at the whole mind-body connection. Sometimes it's just teaching people how to move better. So it really depends on the individual person, but we do help people get to the root cause of their problems and help them figure out what's causing it and what steps they need to take to become more empowered to solve their own problems.
Well, I love that you focus on not relying on pain medication, which we know is a huge problem, injections or surgery. I know a lot of people who've had back surgery. And to be honest with you, it doesn't seem to make things much better. These are also sometimes people who are very adverse to doing things like yoga. You know, how did you get your start and what's the typical client that you see?
Sure. So I started actually back in 2005. I graduated as an athletic trainer, which is, you know, basically the people who run out on the field during a football game when someone gets injured. And that's really what I thought I wanted to do when I was in high school. But I had a forethinking counselor who said, no, that's really no lifestyle that you want. You should pursue physical therapy school. And so I did listen to him graduated with my doctorate of physical therapy in 2008 and gradually moved down the line from treating more of those sports medicine patients to helping, you know, find out that I just got more joy out of helping everyday people who were trying to play with their kids or play with their grandkids or be able to continue working or take care of their household or do the things that really matter, not just getting on the soccer field on Friday night. And over, you know, the years, I started to attract more and more difficult patients. And really now most of my caseload is more chronic pain patients that have tried other physical therapy in the past or have tried injections or some cases surgery, have tried medications, and you really haven't gotten a lot of help. And so that's sort of how I got to where I am now.
That's wonderful. I really feel for people who have chronic pain because, you know, we're in these bodies and if we're lucky, we enjoy being in them and they help us achieve our goals and get where we need to go. And oftentimes, sometimes due to our own self-care or lack thereof, our bodies get in the way of us, you know, really doing what we want to do in life. I'm curious, because you're not relying on pain meds or surgery or injections, what is the protocol and how often do you find that the body-mind connection and shifting the mind helps people deal with their pain?
Yeah, the protocol with chronic pain is that there's no protocol. It is different for every person, but you know, largely we look at things in a biopsychosocial model. And essentially what that means is you look at the body, you look at the thoughts, and then you look at the way that people interact in society. And so we look at people's movement patterns, their posture, what's going on physically in their joints and in their muscles, and then you know, help them learn either through different ways to move, different ways to use their body throughout the day, or sometimes stretches or exercises or hands-on manual therapy type of treatments. That's sort of the bio type of the biopsychosocial model. The psycho is, like you mentioned, anxiety, depression, anger. Many of those emotions affect the way that people perceive pain, that when you are stressed or when you are depressed or when you are angry, it releases chemicals in your brain that you know, make things seem like a bigger problem than they actually are. So you may have physical, let's say, pain signals coming from your joint. But to someone who's not depressed, those may just be like a little nagging thing, whereas someone who is under a lot of stress in their personal life, perhaps, those same signals may produce a larger pain response. And so we look at that. Certainly not a psychologist, but for people who just are a little bit stressed, some things like meditation or yoga are great ways to manage that. For people who have more of a clinical depression, you know, we do have resources that we can refer out to for that as well. And then the social is just basically keeping people doing the things they love, whether that be you know, playing with their family or playing with their kids or grandkids, doing things around the house, exercising, going to the gym, doing yoga. When you can't do the things that you love, it makes the situation seem worse. That if you can get back to people back to the things that they like, even if they are still having some pain, they can usually deal with it. But when it stops them from doing the things that are important to them, that's when it becomes a bigger problem and becomes bigger in their mind.
Wonderful. Thank you. Rick Olderman, welcome to Make America Healthy. I have a question for you. The people that you see in your practice, I would imagine a fair amount of them are perhaps athletes who injured themselves somewhere along the line. But then I'm also assuming that a lot of people are people who just did not take very good care of their body and their pain is a result of that. Can you speak to that a little bit and also tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. Again, thanks for having me on too, Beth. And actually, you know, when I listen to Dave talk, it sounds like a mirror image of my own experience too, because I don't know about Dave, but I found that chronic pain became a focus for me in my practice purely out of necessity. There are just so many people with chronic pain out there. And I don't feel like our, you know, traditional approach to solving pain has, done well with these types of people. And what I see that as the reason I believe this is happening is because of how we're trained is more of this component thinking idea of if there's back pain, we look at the back, or if there's shoulder pain, we look at the shoulder and so forth. And what I find is people with chronic pain typically need more of a systems approach to understanding things, understanding a more complete understanding of the body from a systems solution. And this also includes the mental and dietary issues that you were talking about earlier. So, I graduated in 1996, and frankly, my first couple of years as a PT, I was a miserable failure as far as I was concerned, because anyone with chronic pain who came to me, I just didn't have the tools to really help them. And it didn't seem like many of my continuing education courses helped me in that regard. And when I look back at them, they were all more of this component thinking approach. Actually, Dave lives in the town where one of my mentors lives, Dr. Shirley Sarman. And I started taking her courses, which are more about movement impairments and how that's causing pain and biomechanics. And that's when I started to see a real change in my chronic pain patients.
Wonderful. So I have a question for both of you, and I'd like you both to answer. What role does mindset play in terms of the experience of pain, pain management, and chronic pain? Do you find that people who like do positive affirmations every morning and have a pretty positive mindset are able to just kind of work with and work through it as opposed to letting it run their lives? What's the correlation there?
I would say there's a big correlation. I don't know about the affirmations per se, but there is a huge correlation between people's expectations and what actually happens. That largely people who come in and they're dedicated to getting better, they say, I'm going to do everything I need to get better. And they do. People who believe they're going to get better usually get better. People who come in and are a little bit skeptical, they're a little bit worried, they've tried a lot of things before, and they think, well, do you think this is really going to work for me? I'm not quite certain. If they can't quickly get better in their mind and have the belief that they're going to get better, it's unlikely that it's actually going to happen. So I think you have to heal in your mind before you can actually heal in your body.
Right. It all begins in the mind.
Yeah. My take on that is that, you know, emotional trauma, psychological stress, or other issues not only create a chemical change in the brain, but that is manifested in patterns of dysfunction in the body as well. And so if you are prone to a certain pattern of usage that is causing your pain, that emotional stress tends to become a battery that supercharges that pattern of dysfunction. And so that's when we have to address both the mental and physical aspects of that. So based on your question, you know, positive affirmations are a way to kind of short circuit that negative output that your brain is putting. Even though those patterns might exist in your body, they're no longer supercharged because of positive affirmations.
Right. And because our brains focus on five times the negative to one time the positive, for me, it's daily practice to try to disregard negative thoughts very quickly and change them to more positive ones. I do use a lot of positive affirmations and chanting mantras, all of that. But I'm also wondering, what is the role of the placebo effect in both of your practices? And have you seen this to be true? Again, like you said, Dr. Candy, if a patient believes they're going to get better, do they?
Well, placebo works 30% of the time.
Yeah.
And I think in controlled pharmaceutical studies, they try to control for that and control what's actually an effect of the medication versus what is placebo. And they kind of write that off as, well, that's not real change. That's placebo effect. But change is change.
Change is change.
And so I mean, I really don't care if a person gets better because of something I did or just I changed a way that they thought in their mind and it made them believe that they were going to get better. If they get better, that's really all I care about. And truly, I think that's all they care about either is You know, it doesn't matter whether the pill does what it thinks, what it says it does on the label, if it has the effect that they're coming in and say, in the case of pharmaceuticals, taking the pill for, in our case, coming in for physical therapy or yoga or whatever, that's really all people care about at the end of the day is how can I get better?
Right. And, you know, through Make America Healthy, our goal really is to educate, inspire, and empower. I think a lot of people are become very reliant on their doctor, their physical therapist, their mental health practitioner, where they almost give their own power up. I'm assuming that you both create a co-creation program with your clients that they obviously have to follow certain movements, whether it's stretching, yoga, lifestyle choices such as diet, which is a big topic I would like to unpack with both of you, is the dietary component. But would it be safe to say that the best results come from clients who do feel empowered with whatever they can do at home to help facilitate the work that you're doing?
Absolutely. Yeah, because ultimately the client is the one who's in control of their body, not me. And so, you know, the books that I wrote almost 15 years ago are called Fixing You, because it's not me fixing you, it's you fixing you.
Right.
And you know, I think Dave's and my, both of our goals is to teach people how to solve their own pain, not to make them reliant on other practitioners.
Or pills.
Or pills, or, you know, whatever. You know, I just feel that, you know, the more that people are educated in as to why they're having pain and what to do about it, it gives them that empowerment. And it's one of those things, going back to the mental aspect of this, I feel if you can just give them a lot of people a nudge in the right direction and they see some glimmer of hope or some break in their pain cycle, that gives them that positivity to move forward. And suddenly we can start harnessing that placebo effect a little bit, because they see a positive result, we can build on that. That has a lot of meaning in solving chronic pain.
So you're almost helping your clients create new neural pathways.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. By all means. Not only physical movement patterns, but also mental neural pathways as well, in terms of how to reframe what's happening, why it's happening, and giving them the power to solve that.
So I know that a lot of people who have a health crisis, who adopt the mindset, if it's happening for me, not to me, then begin to make positive life choices, changes in their diet, changes in the people that surround them, changes in their activities. And they end up actually sometimes healthier than when they first started. You know, and I also have friends that go to the chiropractor 5 times a week and refuse to do the in-home treatment to help alleviate the pain. So what do you do with clients that are resistant to doing some stuff on their own?
Yeah. So as far as I'm concerned, one of the keys to helping people believe that we can help them is showing them that we can help them. So we do a test retest. So if some particular movement or activity or, you know, sitting posture or whatever is causing them pain, we make an adjustment in how they're doing that to solve that pain, and then have them repeat that movement again. So that tells them immediately, oh my gosh, that feels 50% better just with what we did. So then I think part of the problem is a lot of times in physical therapy, we throw a lot of exercises at people and hopefully that something is going to work, and it's working in general things. But when you can give someone something that they specifically know is going to solve their pain, and you show that in the clinic, they are more likely to do that. So I frankly, we really don't run into resistant people.
Oh, that's good. That's good news. Tell me, do you advise clients on their diet? Because it's well known that sugar, processed carbohydrates cause inflammation, and inflammation causes more pain. So do you do a thorough review of people's eating protocols?
Personally, where diet and emotional trauma comes into it for me as a physical therapist is my results are very consistent. And if I'm not getting the results I need and the patient needs, then I start considering other issues that may be contributing to an inflammatory issue in their body, such as a dietary issue or an emotional psychological trauma that's locking their body into a painful pattern. And so at that point, they've developed trust in me to talk about this. And so I bring this up, you know, do you have any dietary, you know, issues that, you know, you've explored? Do you have emotional traumas? And we just kind of explore those lightly. I'm not a dietitian, so I'm not trained to talk to people about their diets and evaluate their diets, nor am I a psychologist. So I'm not really trained to talk about them about their emotional issues. However, that gives us a springboard to point them in the right direction for those things if need be.
Right. Thank you. Dr. Candy, what about you? Do you advise on clients' diets?
I would agree with that to some extent. You know, we usually do a screening when they first come in as far as what things are likely to become barriers. And so we will touch on that as one of the main points. And a lot of times people will come in saying, well, you know, my doctor says I just need to lose 50 pounds and my back will be fine. And so there's already some people that come in with an awareness that either weight's a problem or nutrition's a problem. And so, you know, likewise, we're not nutritionists, but we can tell people that, yeah, if you're drinking 2 liters of soda a day, you should probably cut down the sugar a little bit. Or, you know, if you're eating, you know, fast food every day of the week, you should probably lower your saturated fat and get more vitamins and minerals. I'm as far as specifics and laying out, okay, you want to eat this for breakfast and this for lunch and this for dinner. We don't necessarily do that, but I think there's just some very simple, basic lifestyle changes that we can advise people in. And truly, it's amazing that I've found how little knowledge some people in the vast public have about nutrition, that it doesn't take a lot to make a big difference. You know,
no,
stay hydrated, cut down sugar. The big high level tickets. Now, if you're getting into very nitty gritty things, that's where we refer out to nutritionists. But I think there's some big lifestyle changes that you can make a huge impact with.
Well, we're on the verge of a 50% obesity rate right now in the US, and that doesn't even count people who are overweight. Now, I just spent 10 days in Japan. I think I only saw one overweight person on my entire trip. Actually, two, because one was in the hotel lounge and she was from the US. And you know, they seem to have a very healthy population. I actually lost a couple pounds when I was there because this food is so clean, not a lot of carbohydrates, no sugar, no dairy, you know, and those things do cause inflammation. So is there a direct link between the levels of obesity right now and the pain explosion that seems to be going on?
I think for sure. You know, both from the physical aspect that the more you weigh, the more load there is on your spine, the more load there is on your joints. But also there's a similar root cause between the two of them, that poor diet leads to poor tissue healing, leads to poor nutrition of your joints. It leads to increased blood sugar, which makes your nerves more sensitive. So I think there's a big dietary component that leads to both obesity and pain problems, as well as once you are overweight or obese, it does put more physical stress on your body.
Wonderful. Dr. Candy? Tell us a success story about some clients that you've had a miraculous transformation with.
Sure. You know, the biggest transformations for people are the ones that you know, they come in and have the total like disbelief that I've been to so many doctors and this hasn't worked. And I have one particular patient that comes to mind where she came in, she had fibromyalgia. She'd been to a lot of different doctors. And you know, it was something as simple as that all her life she had been told to sit up straight, that you're slouching. If your back hurts, you should sit up tall. And she'd been trying to do that for years and years and years. And just giving her permission that, you know, when you sit up really tall and you're 50, 60 years old, you're going to pinch your nerves more in your joints. So it's okay to slouch a little bit. And she'd almost been going so far to that extreme of trying to have perfect, upright military posture that she started to actually compress her joints together, compress the nerves in her spine, and just saying, you know, you don't have to do that. Teaching her to sit back in her chair and use backrests to allow her back to flatten out and allow her muscles to relax, to allow her to deep breathe. She was able to get back to doing rowing, which she had loved to do and hadn't been able to do. So that's you know, one example of a success story. And I could name a bunch more, but just sometimes it's the littlest changes that make the biggest impact.
Great. Rick, do you see a lot of athletes come into your practice that have injuries?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, Denver's a very athletic town. So yeah, we see a lot of them.
Great. And now I'm going to open this question up to both of you. Are there any specific new technology tools that you're using in your practice? I have several red lights and I do a lot of red light therapy. I mentioned to you before the show, I had a knee issue last year. I was using my red light on it. And I have another friend, she's actually a trainer for YogaFit. She tore her labrum years ago and she's been using a red laser light for years and has avoided surgery because of it. I know a lot of people using oxygen chambers, ozone. So tell us about some cool things you have in your practice.
Well, one of the things in general, I've shied away from using modalities because my focus is on fixing function. And I feel that that's a much more powerful tool to solve pain and problems that are causing pain. However, the past couple of years, I've been using a class 4 laser that has just been a real eye-opener and helper in the clinic to get people over humps of pain. And what I've realized is that, you know, there's fascia in our body, which is connective tissue. And current research in fascia is showing that it relaxes in the presence of nitric oxide. And the class 4 laser is a stimulator of nitric oxide in the body locally. And what is interesting is I spoke with the director of education for the laser company that I purchased it from. He had never heard of that. And the people who I've talked to who, you know, look at fascia research, they've never heard of laser research showing that it creates nitric oxide in the body. So sometimes in medicine, we're not communicating across types of medicine. And some people have answers, but they don't realize it because of this lack of communication. So I thought that was a really fun thing for me to kind of discover in my clinic with my laser.
That's awesome. And that's a localized laser, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Wonderful. How about you, Dr. Candy, using any great tools we should know about?
Much like Rick, we tend to focus more on empowering the patient and self-management things. So do tend to shy away from a lot of things that make people dependent on us and having to come back or dependent on a machine. But I've been doing, it's not new technology, but it's new in the US. I've been doing dry needling for about 5 years. And that's been a total revolution in my practice, that it's just allowed me to get to some deeper muscular restrictions that you just can't get to with exercise or with your hands. And for people who are unfamiliar with dry needling, essentially what it is an acupuncture type needle. But unlike acupuncture, where you put the needles in just underneath the surface and all over the body and leave them in for a long period of time, dry needling involves just putting a single acupuncture needle into a single trigger point in a muscle. And it goes pretty deep. It doesn't feel great while you're doing it, but it has some amazing effects and sometimes immediate changes, sometimes within a day or two. It can do more than people have had done in months or years of other therapies.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. I'm also a big fan of EMS, electronic muscle stimulation. It was originally designed for physical therapy for patients who couldn't really move too much and were in hospital beds. But I actually own 2 machines and I do EMS like once a week. And to me, it's a game changer to really strengthen muscles that perhaps normally I wouldn't be able to hit in the gym. Have either one of you had any experience with EMS?
Like I mentioned, I don't use eSTIM that often to, I just try to get that activation to occur more naturally. So I don't have a lot of experience, but, you know, maybe post-surgically, when muscles are really shut down, EMS, I think, can be particularly helpful to help getting activation to happen.
Great.
I do think it's a helpful tool. And honestly, the units have become so affordable now that for people who would benefit from them, I just send them to Amazon and have them buy their own so that they can use it whenever they want. We don't have one in the clinic, but people ask about it all the time. And I think anything that can either get your muscles activated a little bit more, or even you just using it in a TENS mode to break up the pain spasm cycle, that it may just be a Band-Aid, so to speak. But if it gets you out of pain long enough to stop your muscles from spasming, it can give you some lasting relief.
Thank you. A lot of people who have chronic pain, I'm sure you find, kind of just stop moving their bodies altogether, which you can both speak to on, you know, how beneficial that may not be. What are some ways that people who are at home right now suffering from chronic pain can do some gentle movement to kind of get things moving in their bodies again?
Boy, I think that depends on the specific problem to some extent, but really if you're not moving much or you're afraid of movement, which many people with chronic pain are because they're hurting so much, they're afraid that doing anything is going to make something worse.
Right.
In general, just starting small and then gradually increasing. So whether that be starting a walking program and starting with 5 minutes, it's very unlikely that you're going to injure something further by 5 minutes of walking. And then finding out that wasn't that bad, and then trying 6 minutes, and then trying 7 minutes. Now we can discuss specific exercises for specific joints, but you know, if you're just talking general activity, starting with something that you know is safe, that helps your brain kind of get over the fear of doing it, and then finding out once you did it that hey, it wasn't that bad, and I can maybe do a little bit more, and then you just gradually build on that base.
And what is the most common pain that people come into both of your practices for? Is it back pain? Is it shoulder pain? Is it knee pain?
Back pain.
Yeah, back pain for sure.
85% of people have it at some point in their life. It's probably the most common condition. So I'd say just about any physical therapist who treats a wide variety of things, that's going to be the big thing.
And obviously there can be lots of culprits involved with back pain. But if you could name like the three top issues that cause it, other than we mentioned being overweight, what would those things be?
Sure. So, I've found there are three common patterns of issues that are causing almost all back pain. And two of them are really easy to solve. And one of them involves basically the spine having too much arch in it. And If you've ever lied down on the floor and felt that you needed to bend your knees to your chest to help your back feel better, then you've got a problem with excessive arching of your back.
That's my back.
Yeah.
I'm hyperlordotic. My back.
And so it's not only that the shape of the back is too arched, there are too many forces trying to pull it into the arch.
Right.
Well, one of those things habitually that we all are doing to contribute to this is, If people are listening to the show, just stand up for a minute or two, they'll notice that their knees tend to lock if they've been standing for more than a minute or two. And if you stand up and feel this in yourself right now, go ahead and lock your knees backwards and into a straightened position, and you'll feel that your back arches more. And if you don't feel that, then just go ahead and unlock the knees briefly, and you'll feel that the back arches less. And if you still don't feel that, then go ahead and arch the knees again, and you'll definitely feel the back arch more. So if you're the type of person who needs to bend your knees when you're lying down, or sitting down feels better than standing, then you've got this excessive lordosis or excessive arching of your back, or you've got too many forces pulling your back into that arch. And one of the things that's causing that is your habit of locking your knees when you're standing and walking. So simply changing that habit can remove significant forces in your spine in that pattern. And then the second pattern, and this is usually with involving more unilateral back pain or sciatic pain or a side joint pain, is that one side of the pelvis is higher and the other side and the same size of rib cage is typically lower. I call this a side bending problem. And you can imagine that if you have a lower rib cage on one side and a higher pelvis on that same side, you're going to get more compression on that side of your spine, which is where the nerve roots of the sciatic nerve are exiting from. So typically, and this pattern is very easy to solve, but really we have to understand why is it happening in the first place. And typically that's happening because of some dysfunction in the same side of the pelvis that's higher. So what's happening is your brain over time tries to get you off of that painful or dysfunctional thing. And it starts telling you to start lifting this pelvis higher. Well, the muscles that are lifting the pelvis higher are also attached to the rib cage and pulled out lower, which is what's causing the side bending problem. And this is actually tapping into an old reflex pattern that we're born with called a trauma reflex pattern. So it's happening unconsciously that over time, this gradually happens. You develop that crease. And you can find this in yourself. If you just take off your shirt and ask someone to take a picture of you, you'll see a bigger crease on one side of your back than the other. That's a
How does that affect the shoulders as well? Because I notice when I'm working out in the gym, and I don't like to look in the mirror, but sometimes I do, I notice that one shoulder is higher than another if I'm like doing, external flies or, lifting dumbbells forward. I just notice. And even when I'm doing pull downs, I notice that the right weight is always a little higher than the left, even though I think that I'm pulling them both down at the same time and force.
Right. So it's an excellent question. So if you have for instance, a side bending problem, well, first of all, the dominant shoulder should always be resting lower than the non-dominant shoulder anyway.
So what do you consider dominant? Like, because I'm right-handed, but my left leg is stronger, my left arm is stronger, and my muscles, based upon my in-body scan, my muscles on the left side of my body are more developed.
That's exactly what I am too, Beth.
So I feel, good. I'm glad I'm not the only backwards one.
But it's the dominant side is the side that you use for most of the activities that you do throughout the day.
But riding, the dominant side is not the stronger side.
It's not necessarily the stronger side. Yeah. Exactly. So the dominant shoulder, in this case, probably your right shoulder, should be sitting lower than your non-dominant shoulder. However, if you have a side bending problem where rib cage is also lower, now you've got two things that are pulling that scapula a little bit lower than normal rather than just the shoulder positioning. And if, say, your left shoulder was lower than your right, then and you were right-handed, then I would first look at your rib cage to see if that's lower too. In most cases, that's what's going on. And so there's been a side bending problem that's developed on your non-dominant side.
So how often do you see untreated or undiagnosed scoliosis? Because when at YogaFit, we see it a lot. You know, just watch somebody's body in yoga and you'll notice scoliosis pretty quickly. And sometimes they don't even know they have it. Is that very common?
Oh, very common. In fact, not all scoliosis is considered the same. So you have congenital scoliosis that you're born with, and that's that typical S curve that you have in your body. But in medicine, scoliosis simply refers to a lateral curve in the spine. And so a side bending problem, which isn't true congenital scoliosis, is a functional scoliosis. And so this is probably what you're seeing is some pattern of a functional scoliosis occurring.
The good news is it can become undone.
Well, even congenital scoliosis, for instance, there's a technique called the Schroth method, which is very effective and powerful for fixing congenital scoliosis issues too. But fortunately, the things that solve functional scoliosis can go a long way to solving congenital scoliosis as well. So to go back to your shoulder question, if the rib cage is sitting lower, then that sets up the scapula for poor function. And that scapula or the shoulder blade is half of the shoulder joint. So if that's not working well, that's when pain starts to ensue. So ultimately it can be traced to the rib cage position, but that rib cage position could be traced to some other lower body issue.
Right. And everything's connected.
Correct.
How often are either one of you seeing people come into your clinics that were addicted to pain pills, OxyContin and all of those things that they were giving out like candy 10 years ago until, class action lawsuits started to happen against the pharmaceutical companies and the veil was lifted?
I don't see a ton. I do get a few every now and then. Certainly people who have used it correctly, but not a ton that were addicted. Largely, a lot of our messaging is around helping people without medications, injections, or surgeries. So people who have prefer those methods of help usually don't arrive at our clinic.
Okay.
We do have a few.
I know a doctor who he's had multiple back surgeries, and he takes pain pills every day, and he claims that he's never had to increase his dosage. But I just can't imagine that, 10, 15 years on those pain pills can be that good for the system. Can you both speak a little to the role of pharmaceuticals in pain management and why we should strive to avoid them?
Well, your brain actually produces opioids. If you've ever heard of the runner's high, it's endorphins, and they're opioid-like chemicals that are produced by your brain, but they're 60 times stronger than the man-made ones without the side effects. And when you rely on external opioids, like pharmacological ones, and you do that at excessive doses for a long period of time, your brain starts sensing that, hey, there's enough opioids in the system. We don't have to make any. And if it does that long enough, it just stops, and you actually lose the ability to do that.
Wow, so, which means your workouts wouldn't feel so good either, right?
Probably not. If you're relying on them for that long, you're probably not exercising at that level anymore. But if you take them for too long, then it actually inhibits your body's ability to produce them.
What other harmful effects are there from taking those pills?
Obviously, death is the biggest one.
Yeah.
And,
that's harmful.
It makes your nervous system less active, or your central nervous system less active. And if that gets bad enough, it can actually cause respiratory depression and cause you to stop breathing. But it affects your digestion. It slows down your digestion. It can give you constipation. And there are a lot of other negative side effects.
How about you, Rick? Any comments or weighing in on
pain? Yeah, I just feel, I don't think anyone started their journey with their pain wanting to take opioids. I think the opioid epidemic is largely, in part due to our failure in medicine of solving pain. And so I think it reflects poorly on us in the practice of medicine, because that we haven't found the answers for these people. And so the only recourse they have, because they've been to 8 or 9 other practitioners, unless they've been maybe to Dave or me, who specializes in this, more holistic approach to solving pain, they have no other recourse. And if someone lives in a rural area and they have access to only one person, well, then what are they supposed to do? And so I think, I'm not advocating pain meds or opioids or anything like that, but sometimes people don't have anywhere else to turn. And that's why this whole mess got started. And if we just did better in solving pain, I think, and I think that we are starting to, but I think if we did better, that would also take a large chunk out of this problem.
So when do you think our medical system started to make people just want a quick fix, take a pill, solve all my problems? I can only imagine there was a time in the history, at least of the United States, where people were not so reliant on instant gratification or an external source to solve their problems. And for either one of you who've traveled and practiced outside of the country, is this like an American thing, or do you see this in other countries? Because I presented at a conference in Barbados a few years ago with some colleagues of mine from Harvard. And one of the women was an ER doctor from Lebanon. And I said, is there an opioid crisis in your country? And she said, no, I've only seen in my 15 years of practice one person addicted to opioids. And she said, it's because we don't give them out like candy in our country. Can either one of you speak to that a little bit?
I haven't done a dissertation on this topic, but my general sense is we used to be a more movement-based society, a more agrarian society, and work involved more physical movement. And I think as our jobs required less and less physical movement, I think we stopped having more natural answers to solving our pain. And maybe that had something to do with an increase in this idea of taking medications, because now our jobs aren't helping us move better. And so, you know, just having a sedentary lifestyle or standing in one place for hours, you know, nobody does well with that,
right?
You know? And so, you know, in the absence of, you know, any other answer to that, I think they had to, I think medications became the next logical answer.
Wonderful. Dave?
I would agree with that to a pretty large extent. I do think we've become a lot more of a get it now society with, if you think about, you know, 20 years ago where internet was dial up and you had to log on to AOL and listen to it, you know, do its little hum before you could get on the computer. Now you pick this thing up out of your pocket and you have access to all the information in the world. We've just gotten a little more impatient as a society. And so this kind of get it fixed, instant gratification, order it on Amazon, it's on your doorstep in 2 days. It has become a little bit more prevalent in society.
Right.
And that's not necessarily a medical thing. That's just a system issue.
Yeah. So as we move towards the close of the show, can you each give our listeners some tips for, one, avoiding pain altogether, two, dealing with chronic pain, and three, dealing with acute pain? Dave?
So if I understand this right, it's avoiding pain altogether, dealing with chronic pain, and dealing with acute pain.
Yeah.
So I think to put that maybe in the proper order, avoiding pain altogether maybe isn't necessarily the goal. The pain is an experience that is a normal part of life. And in fact, pain is helpful to us in a lot of cases. It tells us not to touch the hot stove or, you know, to get off the leg if we've sprained a ligament so we don't hurt it further. But that's only productive to a certain point. And so that's acute pain. Acute pain is really when the signal that your brain's getting produces a productive or an adaptive output, meaning it tells you to do something that's good for protecting yourself. And so when you have acute pain, it's smart to listen to it, to do what your body says, to take a day off of the gym or to get off the leg or use crutches for a day or two. Where it becomes more chronic is when that what the brain's telling you to do is no longer protective. So let's say you sprain your ankle, and initially it's a good idea to take a few days off, but 3, 4, 5 weeks, 6 months down the line, you don't need the crutches anymore. And if your brain's giving you signals saying, stay off of it, you don't want to re-hurt it, keep using those crutches, don't take the ankle brace off, that's where you get into the realm of chronic pain, where what the brain's telling you is not in touch with what's actually happening at the tissue levels.
Much so, like people who have experienced some type of emotional trauma in their lives, right? And they have a trigger trauma response, even though the situation is no longer present in their present day existence.
Very much so. Yeah. Like, you know, a veteran who they hear a car backfire and it produces, you know, a sudden, you know, flashback to that instance, or an emotional trauma where maybe you've had a bad abusive relationship in the past. And now you don't trust future relationships because of that past experience. It's very much like that. And, you know, what it involves is retraining the pain to, or the brain to understand that just because this pain is here doesn't mean I'm doing something that's harmful to me. And it's learning to understand what signals actually mean that something harmful is happening and which are just kind of warning signs. And then, like we talked about before, gradually getting back to, you know, more activity, getting your brain to turn down that alarm system so that it's only ringing at the appropriate times and not at the times that are maybe inappropriate.
Right. Thank you. Rick?
Yeah, I think I agree with Dave that it's not a realistic expectation to never expect to have pain. We're humans and we move. And by virtue of that fact, things will develop, you know, painful conditions. However, you know, pain, it can be useful. and it tells us that something is wrong. And if it's an acute issue, you know, most of the times that will just heal on its own with a little bit of rest or you know, a change in that behavior. A chronic issue, I believe that, you know, chronic pain is due to a problem that's wrong now as well. We just haven't figured out what that problem or series of problems are, because we have all the things in our bodies to help us heal. If we cut our finger, it heals. If we break a bone, it heals. So we have the internal mechanisms to heal pain. And so what I find often is that if you're having chronic pain, it's because there's some other hurdle that's preventing that healing from occurring. In my experience, because I'm a physical therapist and I deal with more the musculoskeletal system, has to do with how we're using our bodies. And if we can figure out what those obstacles are and eliminate them, natural pain occurs or healing occurs very rapidly. In fact, almost instantaneously. It's amazing, even with chronic pain. So Using pain as a guide to say whether you've discovered the thing that's wrong or not can be useful.
Right. You know, we use yoga to really learn to listen to our bodies. And oftentimes, I'm sure you'll both agree that the body whispers before it screams. You know, I often find, because I've been very fortunate to be mostly injury free and pain free. But that's, you know, if I overdo it doing too many plank positions to crocodile, you know, I have to back off because I know it, you know, I could end up really injuring my shoulder if I continue that practice. So I've just found personally the role of mindfulness, yoga, using meditation for healing. I even healed a sprained ankle with meditation once, can be very powerful in guiding one towards a more pain-free existence.
Absolutely. Yeah, it all matters.
So any parting words of wisdom for our listeners before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think mine would be that, especially those of you out there with chronic pain, my message to you would be that you're not broken. It's just that you haven't found the right answers yet. And I would encourage you that if you're having pain, it's your body trying to tell you that something is wrong. And if you can just figure that out, you can solve your pain. Because I don't believe our natural state is to be in pain. And sometimes it's harder to find those answers. But, you know, Dave's got lots of great experience and is very knowledgeable. You know, I've got great experience in this area too. There are people out there. If you seek them out, you will find them. Don't give up.
Wonderful. Don't give up.
I think my closing thought is very similar to that, that, you know, having seen a lot of people who have been through multiple doctors and specialists, just because you haven't found the right answer yet doesn't mean there's not an answer to be found. And keep searching until you find that answer, because you can get better than where you are now.
And I'm just going to probably say this on behalf of both of you, but get second and third and fourth opinions before you commit to a knife, a shot, or a pill, right?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay, gentlemen, thank you so much. Dr. Dave Candy, Rick Olderman, they both have great books. They're available everywhere. We're going to put all of their details in the show notes. So if you're suffering from pain, please check out their books and their systems. And stay healthy, everyone. We hope that you remain pain-free and that if you are in pain of any kind, it passes quickly. Remember, the body-mind connection is so very important. So think good thoughts, eat good food, stay hydrated, move your body. And we'd like to thank our sponsor, YogaFit, YogaFit Training Systems Worldwide, the largest yoga school featuring conferences, online trainings, workshops, and special events. You can save 15% at checkout by using the code VOICE22. And if you're looking for me on Instagram, I'm Beth Shaw Health. You can also visit me on my website, bethshaw.com. Tune in next week for another exciting episode of Make America Healthy. And until that time, happy holidays, everyone, and namaste. Thank you both.
Thanks for joining us on Make America Healthy. We hope we've given you some tools you need to take back control of your health. Until next time, we wish you a healthy and wonderful week.